If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another Monday. And you know what that means. It's time for another episode of RFRX, your prescription for coping. I'll be your host. I'm Kara, and I have with me the fabulous, the amazing, the fearless psychic, Helen. How are you?
Good, my friend Cara. How are you?
I am doing well. I am so glad to be here and super excited for this evening's show in particular. So what have you been up to lately?
Enjoying life the best I can. Like we were saying before, my poor kitty cat George, is his legs in a splint, but he's been getting lots of extra cuddles and a lot of extra love because he has a little bit of a sprain. But other than that, my life is pretty good. So how you doing, my friend Cara?
I am doing well. You know, I am not in a splint or anything like that. So I will call that a win. Yeah, that is definitely a plus. I'm fairly accident prone. So it's a good thing anytime that's not happening. So I'll take it. Without further ado, Dr. Ray, would you like to introduce our special guest this evening?
Thanks, Kara. I'm just really thrilled to be able to introduce John Wathy tonight. I was at an Oasis, Sunday morning Oasis, several years ago, and one of my good friends at the Oasis came up to me and said, "Hey, I just read this new book by a guy named John Wathy. I think you might be interested in it." I asked him, you know, about it, and he told me all about the illusion of God's presence. I went right out and got the book. I read the book. I immediately contacted Jack. I found his email or some way, I don't know, remember. And we had a great discussion. A few weeks later, I got on the plane to go out and give a talk at CFI in Los Angeles. And Jack and I were able to connect because he didn't live that far away from CFI. And we've just, you know, been good friends ever since. I had the privilege of getting his manuscript for the book we're going to listen to tonight or listen about tonight, Phantom God. And reading that manuscript just blew my mind. And I think I even wrote a blurb for it, didn't I, Jack? I don't remember. I think I did. Anyway, let me tell you who Jack is. He's a retired computational biologist. Now, don't ask me what that is, but it's pretty sophisticated. And his interest in evolutionary algorithms and the biology of the nervous system is a big part of what and electoral reform. Boy, I didn't see that one before, Jack. He got a PhD in neurosciences at UC San Diego and has spent most of his career working on computer simulations of protein folding. His first book, The Illusion of God's Presence, explores the evolution of the emotions and intuitions behind religious belief, emphasizing behavioral and psychological research. His latest book, and the one we're going to hear about tonight, is The Phantom God, What Neuroscience Reveals About the Compulsion to Believe. It relates the motivating forces behind religiousness to the neural circuitry of embodied mother-infant attachment, adult sexual pair bonding, addiction, selective attention, hallucinations, and many other neurological surprises. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jack and looking forward to this, Jack. Thanks for coming tonight.
Well, thank you very much, Daryl. I'm especially glad to talk to this venue because Daryl is such a good friend. If I remember correctly, my very first podcast interview was with you on your
sexuality podcast.
Yeah, your secular sexuality, I think you called it. That was it was a great opportunity. It kind of got me started in doing this kind of thing. Okay, I am going to share my screen and click a few buttons here. So bear with me for just a minute or two. Okay, I need to turn that off. Come back over here. Okay, I think we're just about ready to go. So last month, some of you, if you heard my talk here about a month ago, I talked about this book, my very first book, The Illusion of God's Presence. In that book, I promised a second book that would explore the neuroscience of human religiousness, which is what Daryl was just talking about. And that has just been published only a week ago, and that's what I'll be talking about today. So here's my outline. In part one, I'll spend a few minutes on where I'm coming from and why I wrote the book. I will also summarize its central message because I can't cover the whole thing in the time we have. Instead, I'm just going to emphasize two of its big ideas. One of those is religious compulsion, which I'll explore in part two. Neuroscience has a lot to say about compulsive behavior, and if we look at religion through this lens, some of its most vexing puzzles start to make sense. These include the tenacity of religion and its obsession with sex. In part three, I'll turn to another big idea, religious phantoms. The feeling of God's presence is a phantom sensation, like the phantom limb of an amputee. Here we will explore how the body is represented in the brain and the strange things that happen when the circuitry of embodiment fails. And finally, in part four, I'll close with some thoughts on why these ideas matter. So that's where we're going. Now let's go on to part one. Why this book and where exactly am I coming from? This is a much younger me celebrating my thesis defense with my advisor, Ted Bullock. Ted is widely regarded as one of the founding fathers of neuroethology. Now, ethology without the neuro prefix is the study of animal behavior in its natural context. The central idea of neuroethology is that to understand how the brain works, we must first understand the problem it's trying to solve. And we can best do that in animals that are highly specialized for a single, well-understood, and easily measured behavior. For example, things like infrared vision in rattlesnakes, the electric sense in weakly electric fish, and song learning in birds, which turns out to be a remarkably useful animal model for understanding language acquisition in humans. Now, my years with Ted had a profound effect on how I understand living things, including humans. And it was during this time that I began to see religious belief through the lens of neuroethology. I noticed something about religion that wasn't getting the scientific attention it deserved. That something was its infantile aspect, which I will illustrate with just a few examples. When believers pray with upraised arms, they're like toddlers begging to be picked up by a loving parent. They're also like newborn infants who reflexively raise their arms that way when startled. In Christianity, you must be born again, that is, become an infant again to be saved by Jesus. And of course, religious infantilism is all over the internet. I worship God in adoration, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. In this meme I'm showing here, the believer is a tiny, helpless infant in the omnipotent hand of God. Now, to me, all of this seemed to fit a pattern commonly seen in ethology. Innate knowledge is an essential foundation for learning. There are many examples of this, like birds learning to sing and babies learning to speak. The neonates of most species have some innate expectation of what the world is like and what they need to do. One of my favorite examples is the behavior of sea turtle hatchlings. Sea turtles usually emerge from their nest at night, and when they do, they need to find the ocean. Their brains have an innate model of what the ocean looks like from a beach. The brightest area on the horizon must be the ocean. Now, that's crude and simple, but it works well in a natural setting. White surf and shimmering waves reflect light from the sky better than sand, day or night. But the hatchlings are also learning. They have a magnetic sense, and as they swim toward the open ocean, they learn how their natal beach is oriented with respect to the Earth's magnetic field. Throughout their long lives, they will travel thousands of miles in the great currents of the ocean, all the while filling in a map of that ocean in their brains. Now, the coordinates are not latitude and longitude, but instead are the strength and inclination of the Earth's magnetic field. Adult females use that map to return to their natal beach, where they lay the next generation of eggs. But in this age of artificial lights, a sea turtle's innate visual model of the ocean can fail catastrophically. At night, the light from beachfront homes can draw the hatchlings away from the ocean and to their doom. In this case, the artificial light is called a supernormal stimulus because it excites the turtle's innate visual model of the ocean even better than the real ocean does. Sometimes adult female turtles also are drawn to artificial lights after laying their eggs, possibly with fatal results. Now, this is surprising because as adults, they should be able to orient to the ocean using only their magnetic sense. Evidently, their innate visual model of the ocean persists into adulthood and somehow overrides their magnetic sense. This is directly analogous to my explanation for the illusion of God's presence in humans. And I know some of you heard about this last month, but I'll just briefly recap some of the main ideas from that. Just as an innate model in the brain of sea turtles sometimes leads adults astray in the face of a supernormal stimulus, I am suggesting that an innate model in the brain of humans can sometimes lead us astray as adults. And my hypothesis about this has three parts. Part one, just as a sea turtle hatchling has an innate model of the ocean and a longing to reach it, a human newborn has an innate neural model of mother and a powerful need to connect with her. And like the sea turtle's innate model, this one is crude and simple. Here are the essential elements of the model as I conceive it. A newborn infant knows that its mother exists, that she knows how to help the infant, that she's able to help, wants to help, and will help when she hears crying. Now, there's a bit more to it than that. The infant also knows that the mother has a face and a voice, and that she provides warmth and nourishment. This crude innate model serves as the foundation for learning the specific details of the infant's real mother and for learning social behavior in general. In part two of the hypothesis, I suggest that the infant's innate model, like that of the sea turtle hatchling, persists into adulthood, but normally lies dormant. And finally, in part three, the existence of this circuitry in the adult can give rise to the illusory feeling of a loving presence, especially, though not necessarily, under conditions that mimic the helplessness of infancy. These feelings are often interpreted in religious terms because God is a supernormal stimulus to the innate model of mother, much like artificial light to a sea turtle on the beach. God is a kind of super parent who answers prayers, is perfectly loving, omnipotent, and omniscient. These exaggerated attributes excite that crude model of a mother even better than a real mother does. And when it's excited, the innate certainty of the mother's existence feeds the certainty of God's existence and the illusion of his or her sensed presence. Now, in my first book, I mainly concentrated on the behavioral evidence for this idea. But as someone trained in neuroethology, that wasn't enough for me. I knew we could learn a lot more from seeing how the brain does this. And that is why I wrote The Phantom God. Which brings us to part two.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days. And now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering From Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
What does religious compulsion look like under the lens of neuroethology? We tend to think of compulsion as a disorder, as in obsessive-compulsive disorder. But there are some behaviors so critical to reproductive success that our compulsion to do them is clearly a good thing from the standpoint of evolution. For example, things like eating, drinking, mating, infantile crying, and caring for offspring. All of these are great examples. And those last two have special relevance for this talk. If I am right about the innate model of mother being a source of religious feelings, then studies of mother-infant attachment in non-human mammals might suggest where in the brain these feelings arise. For example, studies of rats might show us where to look in the human brain. Like human infants, rat pups are born helpless and completely dependent on their mother. She spends a lot of time in contact with them, but if she gets up and briefly wanders around the enclosure, as she's doing in this image, the pups remain calm. The familiar sensations of being in the nest with their siblings are enough to keep them from crying. But when we take one of these pups out of the nest and put it in an unfamiliar place, it instinctively emits ultrasonic cries for its mother. When reunited with her, the pup stops crying. This contact quieting response develops gradually over the first 2 weeks, but it is not a function of learning. It is completely innate. We know this because pups raised in isolation for 2 weeks show the same behavior at that age. And yet, if the pup is raised normally with its mother, there is learning going on. After the pup has had about a week to learn the scent and feel of its mother's body, a special kind of learning called imprinting, then, under the right conditions, it reacts in a dramatic and unexpected way to its mother. Now, to explain this, I need to walk you through the experimental procedure, which was developed by Harry Scher and his colleagues at Columbia University. I will be using his data and his cartoon drawings to show what's happening. Here, the cartoon shows the mother and the pups happily together in their plastic enclosure, as in the photograph. One of the pups will be our experimental subject, and in this graph, I'll show changes in its crying behavior with time on the horizontal axis and rate of crying on the vertical. Let's start with a control experiment. First, we take mom out of the nest and put her in a separate box. The pups, meanwhile, are still in the nest, which is being kept warm by a heating pad, so they remain calm. We leave them there without mom for 15 minutes. Now we move one of the pups to an empty plastic box at room temperature and leave it there for 3 minutes. It immediately starts crying. At 3 minutes, we remove a litter mate from the nest and put it into the box with the isolated pup, and the pup's rate of crying plummets almost to zero. Just the familiarity of a sibling is enough to quiet the formerly isolated pup. This, of course, is contact quieting, which I showed you a minute ago. It would have happened even if we had moved only some wood shavings from the nest into the isolation box, because the pup would recognize their familiar smell. Okay, now at 6 minutes, we move the litter mate back to the nest and the isolated pup resumes crying at the same rate as before. So there are no big surprises here. That's our control experiment. Now let's start over from the beginning so I can show you the interesting and surprising result. Again, the pups are with their mom in the nest. As before, we take mom out of the nest, put her in a separate box, but this time we anesthetize her. We don't want her behavior to confound the experiment. We're interested in the pup's behavior. And again, we leave the pups in their warm, comfy nest without mom for 15 minutes. Now we move one of the pups to the empty plastic box at room temperature and leave it there for 3 minutes. And just as before, it immediately starts crying. Now, at 3 minutes, we move mom, who is still asleep, into the box with the isolated pup. The pup stops crying, just as we saw in the control experiment. And notice that this is entirely response to the mother's presence, not her behavior. She's not licking or grooming the pup. She's not feeding it. She's not picking it up. She's asleep. So far, this looks exactly like the contact quieting we saw in the control experiment. But there is something special about mom. At 6 minutes, we remove her, and now the interesting stuff starts to happen. The pup resumes its crying, but at a much higher rate, sometimes double or even triple the initial rate. In the data I'm showing you here, we see about a 60% increase averaged over all the pups that were tested. This surprising increase in crying rate is called maternal potentiation, because it is specific to the mother. If we do the exact same procedure using only nest material or a sibling instead of mom, the crying rate in the last 3 minutes is the same as in the first three. Only a brief and temporary sensation of the mother's presence causes this enhanced crying behavior. Also, maternal potentiation makes ethological sense. If a pup fell out of the nest in the wild and then only briefly sensed its mother's presence, it would make sense for it to try extra hard to cry out for her because she's probably nearby. This is just the kind of behavior neuroethologists love: understandable, quantifiable, easily recorded, and reproducible in a lab. It's especially intriguing to me because maternal potentiation is an attachment behavior. It happens in the context of separation from mother and involves infantile crying, exactly the kind of situation which, in human infants, would activate my proposed innate model of mother. Maternal potentiation behavior might therefore be useful as an animal model for the illusory sensed presence experience in adult humans. We might get some hints about the neural circuitry behind that illusion if someone could find a place in the rat brain that is specifically implicated in maternal potentiation behavior. Well, luckily for us, Scher and his colleagues did exactly that. They took normal rat pups capable of maternal potentiation. They injected the drug quinprol into a part of the brain called nucleus accumbens, and they found that the drug specifically abolished maternal potentiation. And notice that it did not abolish isolation crying or contact quieting. It only eliminated the increase in crying rate after the pup has briefly felt the mother's presence. Now, quinprol activates a specific kind of dopamine receptor. So the neurotransmitter dopamine must somehow be involved in maternal potentiation. As for nucleus accumbens, here's a cross-section of the rat brain at the level of nucleus accumbens, which turns out to be part of a larger structure called the basal ganglia, which I've shown here in blue. Nucleus accumbens is the lower or ventral part of the basal ganglia, shown here in red. And just to recap briefly, injecting a tiny amount of quinprol into nucleus accumbens abolishes maternal potentiation. But if you do the injection just a little bit higher up in the brain in the upper part of the basal ganglia, it has no effect on maternal potentiation. So it's very specific to that little tiny part of the brain called nucleus accumbens. Well, this is exciting because now we have a foothold in the brain. Now we can ask some more specific questions. What do the basal ganglia and nucleus accumbens do? What do we know about them from other research? What does dopamine do in these parts of the brain? Well, the short answer is that the basal ganglia and dopamine are critical for learning behaviors that involve complex sequences of movement, maintaining these skills once learned, selecting among alternative behaviors, and motivating the behaviors when they are needed. Different parts of the basal ganglia do these things for different kinds of behaviors. In humans, for example, a distinct region within the basal ganglia supports control of the arms, legs, and postural muscles. We know this in part from symptoms of Parkinson's disease, in which a deficiency of dopamine in the basal ganglia causes tremor, loss of fine motor control, and difficulty in initiating movement. And you can see the effects of tremor in this handwriting sample from a Parkinson's patient. Similarly, in songbirds, dopamine and a special part of the basal ganglia are critical for the development of song through reinforcement learning. So what about nucleus accumbens, the place in the basal ganglia that's critical for maternal potentiation in rat pups? What does that do? Well, in essence, nucleus accumbens and the dopamine signaling within it handle those critical behaviors that the brain compels us to do. Now, I'm not saying that nucleus accumbens is the whole story in these behaviors. It's not. Other parts of the brain interpret the animal's environment and internal state to recognize the need for the behavior. And motor cortex and other areas in the brainstem generate the behavior. Also, other parts of the basal ganglia may contribute to some of these behaviors. But during the learning phase, brief dopamine-mediated signals of reward and punishment in nucleus accumbens are essential for reinforcement learning. Later, when the behavior needs to be expressed, the background concentration of dopamine in the basal ganglia, including nucleus accumbens, controls the motivation to act. And we can see this most dramatically in genetically engineered mice that cannot synthesize dopamine. They are so devoid of motivation that they do not eat and will starve to death with food right in front of them unless they are given injections of a dopamine precursor. Interestingly, nucleus accumbens and dopamine are also important in drug addiction, especially in the early stages. Most addictive drugs exert their tenacious effects by increasing the concentration of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, either directly or indirectly. In effect, these drugs bypass the life-enhancing behaviors that are the natural path to reward and instead cut straight to the reward. Finding and taking more of the drug then becomes the overwhelming compulsion. But remember, it was a rat pup's longing for its mother that originally brought us to nucleus accumbens. We followed that lead in the hope that maternal potentiation behavior might be a good animal model for the feeling of a divine presence in human adults. If that idea is right, then we should expect that this kind of mystical experience would also increase activity in the nucleus accumbens. Well, in 2018, Michael Ferguson and his colleagues published a neuroimaging study that found exactly that result. They scanned the brains of 19 devout Mormon subjects as they practiced what Mormons call feeling the spirit. And to give you some clue about what that means, I'll read you this brief description from a Mormon website. Most of us have felt the comforting presence of the Holy Ghost at one time or another. Every one of us who has been baptized and confirmed has been given the gift of the Holy Ghost, which means we have the right, whenever we are worthy, to have the constant companionship of the Holy Ghost. So you see and hear themes of companionship, comfort, attachment. Young Mormons are trained to pray, read scripture, and meditate on Mormon doctrine with the explicit goal of eliciting these feelings. That's what they did in the fMRI machine, but they also had a button they could press when they subjectively reached the peak intensity of feeling the spirit. And here are the results, averaged across 19 subjects at peak intensity of feeling the spirit. These three cross-sections of the brain are taken at the level of the nucleus accumbens. Now, you can see a lot of activity in the cortex, especially near the top and sides of the brain, and that is mostly related to focusing and directing of attention. But I would like to direct your attention to the activity in the small structures at near the bottom of the brain, near the midline, indicated by these red arrows. That is the nucleus accumbens in the human brain, one in each hemisphere. To my knowledge, this is the first direct observation of activation of nucleus accumbens in conjunction with a religious experience. And here's a detailed picture of the time course of activity in the nucleus accumbens relative to the instant of the button press at time zero on the horizontal axis. Now, the signal is greater in the right hemisphere than in the left, but it reaches statistical significance, as indicated by the blue bars, on both sides of the brain. And I should point out here that there's a time delay of about 5 or 6 seconds in this measure of activity, which is really a measure of blood oxygenation changes, which are triggered by electrical activity in the neurons. So there's a delay of about 5 or 6 seconds. If we subtract out that delay, you can see the actual peak of neural activity occurs at about 1 or 2 seconds before the button press. So the studies of maternal potentiation in rat pups and feeling the spirit in Mormons both implicate the nucleus accumbens in these behaviors. This neural connection between infantile attachment and adult religious experience supports my hypothesis that relates an innate model of mother to the feeling of a divine presence. And because of other things we know about the nucleus accumbens, these results may partly explain some long-standing puzzles. For example, why is religious belief so tenacious? People cling to their faith despite contradictory evidence, failed prophecy, corruption of the clergy, and sometimes great personal cost. So why is this? Why is religiousness so tenacious? Well, I think there's an answer from neuroethology. Considering that intense religious experience excites the nucleus accumbens, which also happens to be the epicenter of drug addiction, maybe faith is tenacious, at least in part, because it is addictive. And here's another puzzle about religious compulsion. Why is religion so obsessed with sex? Why do preachers rail against sins of the flesh, only to be caught with their pants down doing those very things? Why do priests sexually molest children and adolescents? Why did male followers of this cult leader submit to castration in pursuit of holiness? And here's one of my favorite examples. This is Bernini's famous sculpture depicting the ecstasy of Saint Teresa of Avila, ecstasy delivered by an angelic visitor. This scene comes from Teresa's memoir, and you don't need to be Freud to figure out what's really going on here. In his hands, I saw a great golden spear, and at the iron tip, there appeared to be a point of fire. This he plunged into my heart several times so that it penetrated my entrails. When he pulled it out, I felt that he took them with it and left me utterly consumed by the great love of God. The pain was so severe that it made me utter several moans. The sweetness caused by this intense pain is so extreme that one cannot possibly wish it to cease, nor is one's soul then content with anything but God. This is not a physical, but a spiritual pain, though the body has some share in it, even a considerable share. Like nearly all religions, Catholicism is strangely conflicted about sex. When Teresa entered the convent, she was taught that her celibate life to come is the price paid for the privilege of being wedded to Christ. Similarly, priests are told they are marrying the church. And yet they are also taught that sex is sinful. That's why they're supposed to be celibate and why Jesus was supposedly conceived without sex. Teresa's vision is unusual in that it embraces sexuality as a religious experience. So why is this? Why is religion so obsessed with sex? I think neuroethology has an answer to this puzzle too, but there are many pieces of the puzzle I'll need to put together, so bear with me here. We have seen that both infantile longing for mother and adult longing for God share a common mechanism in the brain. It turns out that adult sexual pair bonding in monogamous species also shares this mechanism. The best evidence for this comes from studies of prairie voles, a social rodent that forms monogamous pairs. Now, this is a fascinating story. Unfortunately, I don't have time to give you the details, except to say that nucleus accumbens and related structures are at the heart of it. Something similar probably underlies adult sexual pair bonding in humans. But by themselves, the connections I've just shown you here still do not explain the strange obsession with sex in religion. There is one more critical piece to this puzzle, and it has to do with the way evolution innovates by reusing what's already available. So allow me a brief digression. For example, we know that the wings of angels did not evolve. They must be the product of an intelligent designer because they just magically appear tacked onto the body without repurposing the arms. By contrast, theropod dinosaurs also acquired wings, but only gradually and through the repurposing of their forelegs. The wings of birds evolved. Similarly, in making prairie voles and humans monogamous, evolution has evidently reused the mammalian compulsion for attachment between mother and infant, tacking on some tweaking of the circuitry at puberty to redirect affection to one's mate. But if my hypothesis about religion is right, then that tweaking is somehow sloppy and incomplete. There's a downside to the way evolution has made us monogamous. It makes us prone to infantile feelings as adults. According to my hypothesis, the infant's innate model of the mother persists into adulthood and spawns a kind of religiousness that casts the believer as a helpless infant in the hands of God, the superparent. The more pious the believer, the more infantile his or her feelings. But remember, this is happening in the brain of an adult whose attachment system has been tweaked for sexual pair bonding. This intense and infantile love of God therefore inevitably spawns sexual feelings toward a parental figure, and that triggers yet another compulsive behavioral system, incest avoidance. Infantile and sexual feelings for God trigger revulsion at the prospect of incest. That's the missing piece to this puzzle, the compulsion to avoid incest. Because of evolution's careless shortcuts, the intensely pious tend to be flooded with love, lust, and revulsion. All of these are conflicting emotions of unconscious origin generated by innate mechanisms, which were selected for neonatal survival, adult sexual pair bonding, and incest avoidance. The predictable result of this conflict is an obsession with controlling or prohibiting sexual behavior, coupled with an almost irresistible drive to violate those prohibitions. Now, in this talk, or this part of the talk, I have tried to show you what the neuroscience of compulsive behavior can explain about religion. But it's not the whole story. Neuroethology led us to the nucleus accumbens and its role in compulsive behaviors. But this accounts for only part of the innate model of the mother and only one aspect of the illusion of God's presence, the intense longing for a divine savior and the compulsive drive to reach it. One missing part is the spatial aspect of a sensed presence, the feeling that another being is physically nearby. This is handled in a completely different part of the brain. And that brings us to part three, religious phantoms. The central idea here is that there is a deep connection between the phantom limb of an amputee and the illusion of a sensed presence. And we can see evidence of that connection in the brain. I'll begin with a lesson that shows up repeatedly in neuroscience. Perception comes not only from sensory input, but also from what the brain expects. The brain's expectations make us more sensitive to important stimuli, like human faces. So sensitive that we sometimes see faces that aren't there at all, like this famous one on Mars. In this case, the brain is filling in missing information in this ambiguous shape to make us see a face. something like this, the filling in of missing information, also happens in the illusion of a phantom limb. But the percept is especially vivid because the brain always expects bodily sensations. Not only do we have the sense of touch from our skin, but we also have receptors in our muscles and connective tissue that sense the position and movement of our limbs. The perception of a phantom limb is so vivid and compelling that amputees will sometimes spontaneously try to answer a phone or break a fall with their phantom. And there's nothing uniquely human about this. Cats that have had an amputation will sometimes try to use their phantom to scratch themselves. To play with their pet human. Or to bury their poop. Now, if you only remember one thing from this talk today, I hope you will remember the impact of that video I just played. When I first saw those clips, I felt great empathy for the cats with their disabilities, but I was stunned at how real the phantom is to them. For people who have felt God's presence, their God is just that real, and for the same reason. Illusions of embodiment are qualitatively different from other illusions. They come with a feeling of knowing that's hard to convey. Psychologist William James, who suffered from depression and was himself a religious believer, put it this way. If you have intuitions at all, they come from a deeper level of your nature than the loquacious level which rationalism inhabits. Your whole subconscious life, your impulses, your faiths, your needs, your divinations have prepared the premises of which your consciousness now feels the weight of the result. And something in you absolutely knows that that result must be truer than any logic chopping rationalistic talk, however clever that may contradict it. Earlier, I suggested that faith is tenacious, at least in part because it is addictive. But this feeling of knowing is another reason for that tenaciousness. Faith comes from an illusion of embodiment. To understand this illusion at the level of the brain, we need to see how the brain represents the body. And I will start with some diagrams and then map these onto the brain. First, sensory information coming from the limb and command signals going out to the muscles are handled in different parts of the brain. The sensory part is called the somatosensory system, and the command part is called the motor system. Each of these is hierarchically organized, but I will illustrate that hierarchy only for the motor system. And don't worry about the details here. I'm only showing this to point out that the higher level areas handle the conscious initiation and control of complex movements. And the lower level parts are the ones most directly connected to the body. The lowest level part of the motor cortex is called the primary motor cortex, and you will be hearing that phrase or seeing it in the slides that are about to come. Another phrase I'll be using is the primary somatosensory cortex, which is the lowest level cortex in the sensory system. And if all of that is too abstract or confusing, maybe seeing it on the brain will help. On the brain, the primary motor area is the strip of cortex colored green in this drawing. And similarly, the primary somatosensory area is the purple strip of cortex adjacent to the motor area and behind it on the brain. In each of these cortical areas, the body is represented as a distorted but recognizable map. Each hemisphere of the brain maps the opposite half of the body. And here's a cross section through the left side of the primary somatosensory cortex, showing the map that represents sensations from the body. And on the right here, I'm showing the motor half. This is a map from the primary motor cortex that represents the location of the muscles controlled by each of those places in the motor cortex. Now, the maps are distorted like this because a part of the body that needs delicate sensation or precise control of movement, like the hand, needs more neurons in the brain. We can explore these maps using a strong magnetic field. This technique is called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. The magnetic field induces electric currents in the cortex just below the coil. This scrambles the neural computation that would normally be going on in that part of the brain with some interesting effects. In primary somatosensory cortex, it yields illusory sensations on the skin. And in primary motor cortex, it causes involuntary twitching of muscles. When this is done in the part of the map representing the missing limb of an amputee, the subject feels illusory touch sensations or illusory muscle twitching in the phantom. Now, over time, these low-level areas get rewired in amputees. Notice that the hand area is adjacent to the face in both the sensory and the motor maps of the body. So if a hand is amputated, it's easy for neural fibers from the face area to spread into the adjacent hand area of the cortex. If this happens, a touch on the face may then be felt as an additional touch sensation on the phantom limb of the patient. And that's being mapped here in this image on the right, which comes from neurologist V.S. Ramachandran. Another kind of change that often happens with phantom limbs is a shortening of the phantom forearm, such that the phantom hand is perceived as being attached near the end of the stump, even if the stump ends near the elbow or the shoulder. So I've just shown you evidence that the neural circuitry of embodiment can change, that it's plastic. But is it entirely so? Or is neural embodiment partly innate? Now, I raise this question because when I was telling you about ethology, I said that innate knowledge is an essential foundation for learning in highly specialized domains. So is embodiment one of those domains? Is that also partly innate? I also described my hypothesis of the innate neural model of the mother, which requires some degree of innate embodiment. So the question really constitutes a test of that hypothesis. Well, luckily, there is some evidence on this question. One line of evidence for this comes from studies of transsexuals. People who feel they're trapped in a physical body of the wrong sex and seek gender reassignment surgery. Typically, they report having these feelings since childhood, which suggests there's something innate about this. Neurologists V.S. Ramachandran and Paul McGeoch hypothesized that an innate neural model of bodily gender develops prenatally as the genitals themselves develop, presumably at the direction of hormonal signals. Typically, the two processes match. For example, a neural model of male genitals arises in the brain of a fetus that is developing a penis at the same time. In a minority of people, however, and for unknown reasons, the hormonal signals don't match in the two target structures. Maybe the dose of the hormone is too little in one place. Maybe it arrives at the wrong time. Whatever the cause, the two diverge. A neural model of a female body develops in the brain of a person with male genitals, or vice versa. Ramachandran and McGeoch came up with an elegant way to test this hypothesis. If this aspect of embodiment is innate, then in a typical male brain, in a male body, the brain expects the body to have a penis. But the brain of a man who feels he's in a woman's body is a brain that has an incomplete or missing representation of the penis. His brain does not expect the body to have a penis. Men who transition to women should therefore be less likely to experience a phantom penis after surgery than men who undergo removal of the penis for other reasons, like cancer treatment. By the same reasoning, women who transition to men should be less likely to experience phantom breasts than women who undergo mastectomy for breast cancer. Well, the neurologist went ahead and did this study. And here's what they found. Transsexuals, shown here in blue, have significantly lower incidence of phantom sensations than cancer patients who had the same body part removed. Also, in data not plotted here, 62% of female-to-male transsexuals described having phantom penis sensations before their transition. That's how strong their sense of male embodiment had been. That's fairly strong evidence for an innate neural model of the body, at least with respect to gender and sexuality. A similar mismatch between body and brain occurs in a rare condition called xenomelia, in which a person experiences a normal and healthy limb as being somehow alien to their bodies, so much so that they seek its amputation. Now, this is essentially the inverse of a phantom limb. The limb is physically present and completely normal, but part of the neural model of it is somehow missing or malfunctioning in the brain. These feelings typically appear in childhood, more often in a lower limb, and only part of the limb is usually perceived as being alien. Like transsexuals, these individuals appear to be driven toward drastic surgery by a feeling so compelling that it persists in the face of bodily evidence to the contrary. But perhaps the most dramatic evidence for innate embodiment comes from studies of subjects with congenitally missing limbs. In the study I'm citing here, it describes a woman who had been born without arms or legs and yet had experienced vivid phantom sensations of all four limbs for as long as she could remember. The numbers shown on the diagram here are her subjective vividness ratings at specific locations on the phantoms, averaged over three separate sessions, with zero meaning no sensation and six meaning most vivid. And to test the authenticity of these phantom sensations, the subject was shown a series of drawings of a hand or a foot and had to identify them as left or right as quickly as possible. Subjects with complete limbs do this task by comparing the drawing to a mental image of their own hands or feet. When the digits are pointing down, as in the bottom row, this comparison requires a mental rotation, which significantly increases the subject's reaction time. And you can see that here for three control subjects. At the bottom row, you can see the reaction times are significantly longer than in the top row, where you don't need the mental rotation. Well, it turns out our subject with the missing limbs has exactly the same pattern of behavior. She also has a longer reaction time, significantly longer reaction time, when she has to do the mental rotation, which shows that she's using the same technique. She's mentally doing a rotation of her phantom limbs to do this left-right discrimination. But here's the most interesting part. These images show areas of activity in the subject's brain while she's sequentially touching each finger of one phantom hand to the phantom thumb. Now, the pattern is similar for both the left and right hands. But one of the most striking things is that the low-level cortex that would normally represent the hand, we're talking about the primary somatosensory or primary motor cortex, which in this illustration here is indicated by the white arrows. That primary motor cortex area is completely inactive in this subject. These would be the most active areas in an amputee who had lost the hand as an adult. Instead, when this subject moves her phantom fingers, the neural activity is in the higher level motor areas in the frontal lobe and in the superior parietal lobe farther back in the brain. The authors conclude that representation of the body probably arises from a combination of innate and learned mechanisms, with the innate components mostly in these higher level areas. The ones in the frontal lobe now, as I said earlier, are known to be involved in the conscious initiation of movements. But for our purposes, the parietal lobe is more interesting. This is where abnormalities are found in subjects with xenomelia, the desire to amputate a limb that feels alien. It's also where we see a connection between embodiment of the self and the perceived embodiment of others. One of the first people to make that connection was British neurologist MacDonald Critchley, who put it this way. Among the vague and curious anomalies of corporeal awareness or body image occurring with lesions of the subordinate parietal lobe, an idea of a presence may intrude. This intangible feeling, perhaps amounting to a firm belief, but subsequently proving to be erroneous or delusional, is so unexpected, incongruous, and uncanny as to disturb the victim. Like the amputee in his phantom limb, he may well prefer not to mention it. It's no accident that Critchley compared the illusory sensed presence to a phantom limb. The two share common neural hardware, something Critchley inferred from his patients. One of his patients felt that the left half of his body did not belong to him. While walking, this patient would sometimes get the notion that he was being followed behind and to his left by another person. When he had this sensation, he lost the feeling of strangeness that affected the left side of his own body. What Critchley called the subordinate parietal lobe is today more commonly known as the inferior parietal lobule, part of the transition zone between the temporal and parietal lobes, or temporoparietal junction. Now, that name is kind of a mouthful, so I will be abbreviating it to TPJ, but what it does is absolutely fascinating, and I wish I had more time to tell you about it. In essence, it handles the neural embodiment of the self and others in many amazing ways, but I want to concentrate on what Critchley was pointing out here, the feeling of a presence. Direct electrical stimulation of the TPJ can sometimes elicit the illusion of a sensed presence. This paper describes a patient with a history of epileptic seizures in her left temporal lobe. At onset, she would slowly turn her head and eyes to the right, though she had no memory of this after the seizure. While searching for the focus of her seizures with stimulating electrodes, her physicians found that direct electrical stimulation of her left TPJ gave her the illusion that another person was standing behind her on her right side. She could not explain how she knew the person was there, but she felt that the sensed presence was threatening. Here's another example. As in the previous case, this was an epileptic patient whose cortex was being mapped with stimulating electrodes. When her left TPJ was stimulated, she felt the presence of a person directly behind her. When she was lying on her back during the stimulus, she felt that the person was lying beneath her. When she sat up in bed and clasped her arms around her raised knees, she felt the other person's arms around her upper body, a sensation she found disturbing. When asked to do some simple tasks with her hands during the stimulus, she said the other person was trying to interfere with her actions. The sensed presence so faithfully mimicked this patient's behavior that it was obvious to the neurologist that she was misperceiving her own body as an alien presence. Now, the patient was aware of this mimicry, yet she never interpreted the presence as her own body, evidently because her mind could not penetrate the illusion that another person was there. All of this strongly implicates the TPJ in the awareness of the presence of another person, and that makes it a likely component of an innate neural model of mother. And if my central hypothesis is right, the TPJ should also be critical in the illusion of God's presence felt by an adult. But I need to make some disclaimers about this point. The kind of sense presence that comes from electrically stimulating the TPJ is not exactly what I have described as coming from an innate model of mother. In the neurological examples I just gave you, the sensed presences were disturbing or threatening, not unconditionally loving. The spatial and the personal aspects of the illusion were there, but the longing and attachment were not. Those things come from elsewhere in the brain. And I've listed here some of the important places that I've neglected in this talk. Now, in the book, I do my best to complete the story, but we just don't have time for that now. In the last chapter of the book, I list testable predictions and my suggestions for experiments. I don't have time for those either, unfortunately, except to give you the overarching prediction that they all exemplify. The crying of a newborn infant for its mother and the helplessness of an adult in despair should share a common neural mechanism. Similarly, the love and security felt by a suckling infant and the feeling of ecstatic union with a divine presence should also share a common neural substrate. The correspondence of these infantile and adult mental states should be evident in similarities of localization in the brain, of neuronal activity, and sensitivity to drugs. If that correspondence cannot be found, then the hypothesis is wrong. Maybe the hypothesis will fail and be discarded. But what if it passes? Suppose we find that deep commonality in an infant's neural representation of its mother and an adult's representation of a mystical presence. So what? Why does any of this matter? Since prehistoric times, humans have tried to explain what they don't understand as actions of supernatural beings. But with the rise of modern science, we've discovered natural explanations. Today, there are few educated people who seriously believe that thunder and lightning come from Thor's hammer. As the gaps in our knowledge shrink, so does the God of the gaps. But this gap, the God-shaped vacuum in our hearts and minds, is one of the few remaining places where the God of the gaps still hides, even for scientists as distinguished as Francis Collins and my own thesis advisor, Ted Bullock. If it can seduce them, no wonder it captures billions more. If my hypothesis passes its tests, we will have a completely natural explanation for the feeling of God's presence, an explanation grounded in evolutionary biology, ethology, and neuroscience. It will mean that we better understand why we invent religions and long for that mystical other. And if my hypothesis fails, it will not mean that God wins by default. With luck, the experiments that shoot it down will hint at better hypotheses. With cleverness and hard work, we will eventually tease out the truth from among them. That's how science works. Science brings us ever closer to reality, and having a firm grip on reality is good for human flourishing. The science of electricity did more than merely vanquish Thor. It opened our eyes to the majesty of the real cosmos. It brought us the modern world. It even made this Zoom meeting possible. We live in a paradoxical time. Cultist tribalism and religious groupthink threaten our democracy. And yet secularism is growing in America, especially among the younger generation. My hope is that a scientific understanding of where religion really comes from will help. For me, at least, that's why all of this matters. You can learn more about this at my website, wathiresearch.com, and of course, even more in my book, The Phantom God. And with that, I will be happy to take questions. Let me turn that off.
Wonderful. And we have many questions. That was so fascinating. Thank you so much for breaking that down for us. It is a lot of information, like you said, and I know a lot of people in the chat have mentioned that they are going to go out and get the book to get the rest of the details, because that was a lot. So thank you. And without further ado, let's get to the questions. So first and foremost, and I have to second this question, people want to know, Are there any plans for an audiobook version of either of these books? And are you going to read them?
Well, I've just, before we started tonight, Daryl Ray gave me some advice about that. He's urging me very strongly to do that. So I will be contacting my editor and pressing for that. I would love to do it. I'd absolutely love to do it.
Oh, that would be amazing. I love that. And yeah, as some people in the chat are saying, whenever an author reads their own works, I am all over that. I feel like you get more of a sense of what they meant to convey. So I hope that works out. I'm super excited. Okay, what else? Helen, do you want to pick a question to ask? We have a whole bunch here.
Yeah, we do have a lot. And I just want to say this was a really fascinating talk. I learned some really new stuff and get my noodle going. So thank you so much. I wanted to get that off before I started moving on to the many questions we have. So there's another question. It seems like the language about God is often father rather than mother. What is the interplay between the name mother instinct and God the Father?
Okay, this is a great question. And I'm really glad you brought it up early, because I've completely neglected that whole side of religion. I should make the disclaimer that the idea I've presented in the talk tonight, and the one I talked about a month ago also, which is basically the same hypothesis, only covers part of religion. It does not claim to explain everything about religion. And there's a huge amount of religion having to do with the maleness of God, the judgmental aspect of God, the God who punishes and rewards, the God who is fearsome, sort of an alpha male figure. That's what most of the psychology and anthropology of religion has dealt with. And there are many books on that subject. There's one by Hector Garcia, I think it is the author, called The Alpha God. There's one called Big Gods by Ara Norian Zion. So there's a great literature on that, going all the way back to Durkheim, really, back in the 19th century. This part of God that I've been talking about here is a newer thing. I think it's really only been seriously dealt with by since the 1990s, and I'm putting a new wrinkle on it with my ideas from neuroethology. But I should say, since you brought up this question, that both dimensions of religion, the authoritarian male God and the unconditionally loving sort of feminine God, mother-like God, both of those can be found in just about any of the world's major religions. They're sort of in a conflict with one another, and yet believers very often accept both of them despite the contradictory nature of them. I start off this new book with a chapter called Why is God Two-Faced? And that whole chapter is directly addressing this question that you've just raised. So the short answer is there are two dimensions of religion, and I've mostly been talking about one of them, the feminine aspect of God.
Okay, yeah, that's great. I have a follow-up question here, kind of on a similar topic, that I have a feeling though the answer is going to have more to do with animals not being exactly analogous to humans. I should say other animals not being exactly comparable to humans. Someone was wondering, in the experiment that you talked about with the rat pups, where the mother comes and they're crying out at different rates, did they ever do that test with the presence of the rat father instead of the rat mother?
Yes, they did, actually. Now, there are huge differences between, and it's good that you brought this up, there are huge differences between rats and humans. We all know that, of course, obviously, many differences. And so you have to be careful when you're using experiments like this to give you hints of where to look in the brain. You always have to have that qualifier there that, you know, this isn't necessarily going to be like the human brain. But yes, they did that experiment with fathers, and adult male rats are actually threatening to pups. Especially if it's a male that's not the father, but one that wants to take over the female and mate with it, the male may kill the pups. So the adult males are a threat to the pups. And so you get completely different result when you when you put them with a male, an adult male rat, they will go silent. And when you take the male away, they will not start crying again. They'll stay silent because they're terrified. So it's a very different behavior. Now, there's a variation on that theme though. If you allow the male to be in a cage adjacent to where the nest is, so that the pups can smell the male while they're living in the nest with their mom, then you get a contact quieting with the male. Then they're no longer terrified of the male because that male becomes familiar to them. So it's very subtle, actually. You get different kinds of results with the males, depending on experience.
Ooh, interesting. Okay. Very cool.
So kind of the off of that. So do brain scans show the feeling of the spirit from adults or children? And is there a difference between what those brain scans show?
As far as I know, that experiment was never done with children. So I just don't know the answer. I don't think that answer is known. There is a lot of what I talk about in the book has to do with studying the brains of human children, though. Those techniques are improving. We're getting better at that. It's hard to do those experiments because, especially with newborn infants or small infants, they're very fussy. They want to move their heads a lot, and you need to keep the head still for some of these techniques. But there are other techniques where you can put sensors directly on the scalp and get some good information that way. So that's a new area of research. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work to be done there.
Fascinating. Okay, so someone else was asking if you could say a little bit more about this lust and repulsion conflict. They were asking, is it because the more infantile part of the brain sees the god as a mother figure and the adult part of the brain sees the god as a mate, or what's going on with that piece of it?
It's basically the problem is there. What evolution has evidently done is it's used the circuitry for attachment between mother and infant and reused it. You basically reuse that same attachment mechanism in adulthood for sexual pair bonding to make human mates just as tightly coupled to one another as an infant is to its mother, so that we'll tend to be monogamous and the male will participate in raising the child and so on. There's a lot of reasons for it. But because it's reused, you've got the same neural circuitry that can do both of these things. So our infantile and sexual aspects are kind of intermingled. You can see it in very subtle ways. For example, when we talk about our lovers or sing in popular songs about lovers, you know, I got you, babe. You know, I found $1 million baby at the 5 and 10 cent store. Just about any, you know, love song that you hear in the media, there somewhere in there, there's going to be babe or baby, something like that. When a lover is when an adult is referring to his or her lover, so it's just constant jargon. But and why specifically are breasts so sexually exciting? Why are breasts sexualized in humans? You know, they're there for nourishing infants, but they are the focus of sexuality in human adults. That's another example where there's this crosstalk where the two systems are obviously intermingled in it, and it shows up in our behavior. And religion just makes this worse. Religion just, it makes people more infantile than they would normally be, much more infantile if they are especially pious, if they are so devoted to God that they are willing to sacrifice their sexuality, declare themselves celibate, become priests or nuns, give up all of that to become an infant to God, a servant to God, a child of God. And yet, because this hormonal stuff has already happened in their brains when they went through puberty, the circuitry has been rewired to seek out a sexual partner. then it, at some unconscious level, the two are really powerfully mixed together and confused. And so, at, again, mostly at an unconscious level, it's not like they've reasoned this out. Oh, God is this really hot thing that I want to have sex with, and he's my father or she's my mother. They don't reason this through. This is happening at an unconscious level. But all of these unconscious innate systems get triggered. They're filled with these feelings of lust and love and revulsion because of what's going on just beneath the surface of consciousness. That's what I think is going on.
Oh, okay. Got it. Interesting.
So, kind of, there's a lot about the bond, obviously, because it's actually very fascinating. So why do most Christian religions have a strong attachment to this God, Jesus, as a male? And how do you think it relates to that mother-infant bond?
Yeah. Again, that's that gets back to what I was discussing before, that, yeah. that you know, you have both male and female figures in religion. Now, there are plenty of religions in the world, like Hinduism, where you have lots of maternal goddesses or female goddesses. And some of them are loving, nurturing female figures. And in Catholicism, where you have a patriarchal religion where women are not even allowed to be priests, where men clearly dominate the theology and the hierarchy and everything, even in a religion like that, the feminine side of God creeps in whether the Pope wants it to or not. And you have the veneration of the Virgin Mary, the praying to the saints for special favors and solving problems. And the saints, of course, are mostly female. The female saints outnumber males 2-1 in Catholicism. So that's those are examples where the feminine side creeps into the religion. Another good example is Islam, which is most of what we hear about in the news having to do with Islam is a religion of a fearsome God, a judgmental God, a cruel, punishing God, a God of vengeance, a God who inspires religious violence. That's what makes the news. But within Islam, you have the Sufi movement, which does exactly the opposite. It goes the other direction. It emphasizes the infantile and maternal aspects of God. And they even do a role reversal where they think of God as an infant that lives within the heart of the believer, and the believer must nourish and nurture and care for this spiritual infantile God that lives within them. So they've sort of defanged the cruel and judgmental God by casting him as an infant. We do that in Christianity with baby Jesus, by the way. So I talked about that last time. So that's basically how I would put it. These two things are always in tension, and various religious movements will try to push one or the other out, and they can never completely succeed. They keep coming back. And I think that's because they come from these powerful intuitions deep in the human mm-hmm. mind.
Interesting. Okay, so shifting gears, somebody else had more of a physiological question, and they're wondering, do you find less religiosity in people with a dysfunctional nucleus accumbens, or has that been tested?
That in a way it has, not through any kind of direct experiment that I know of, but you find less religiosity in Parkinson's patients. They will often drop off in their religiosity, and they are suffering a deficiency of dopamine, not specifically in nucleus accumbens, it's in the broader basal ganglia, but that's one of the things that tends to happen in Parkinson's patients.
Okay.
Cool. So this kind of also on that discussion of the mental aspect of these things. So do people with antisocial mental conditions sense the presence of other people differently?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's safe to say The answer is probably yes. But you remember I said that that part of the brain, the temporoparietal junction that handles the physical sensation, the spatial sensation mm-hmm. of a person's presence, where you sort of have a feeling of how far away the person is, what direction they are relative to your body, that aspect of sensing a presence. That lacks the kind of love and attachment feeling that is the thing that draws people together, that makes them sociable, makes mm-hmm. them interact, makes friends, and so on. Those feelings, I think, the bulk of the evidence is that those are coming more from the prefrontal cortex and especially the orbitofrontal cortex. It's an area of cortex that's on the underside of the frontal lobes, just above the eyes. And in that area, there's lots of interesting stuff going on. I have a chapter just about that one part of the brain. Just to give you a little flavor for it, you can, with these sensors I was telling you about that you could put on the scalp of an infant, they detect changes in neural activity through changes in blood oxygenation with infrared light. Okay, so that technique shows that the orbitofrontal cortex is active when an infant is responding to its mother, when it's hearing its mother sing or speak in motherese, or read a story to the child in motherese, when it's familiar with its mother's voice, that activates that part of the brain. In an adult, damage to that part of the brain causes acquired sociopathy, a condition where exactly the kind of thing your question was asking about, where you lose the ability to form close relationships, you lose empathy, you become sort of selfish and cruel in your interaction with other people. It's a fascinating part of the brain.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay, so this kind of leads into another one that I definitely want to hear the answer to as well. Someone asked, what does all this mean for weirdos like me who have never felt God's presence? I believed what others told me to believe, yet was frustrated that I never felt anything. And I can definitely relate to that. What's going on? Are we broken?
I would not say so. No, I would say that this is one of those things that varies from person to person. It's a trait, you know, we all vary along a spectrum with respect to these things. It may be partly that you've never been in a situation so dire, so stressful, so life-threatening, so emotionally, you know, crushing, that you were brought to the level where you started to perceive this mysterious, vague savior out there, because your brain triggered that illusion from the expectation that an infant has that the savior is out there, meaning the mother, of course, in the case of the infant. Mm-hmm. Some people have never been that deep in despair to have that triggered. Other people may have it triggered, and for whatever reason, skepticism, whatever, can see, well, I'm just upset. That doesn't mean anything, and shrug it off. As it's happened to me a couple of times, I've had that feeling. And I could, when it happened to me, I had great empathy for believers because I could see how easily it would be to project God into that feeling. But this was after I had, you know, had years to think about this, and these ideas were already well established in my mind, and I could see through it, and I could see it and interpret it as the infantile sort of feeling that I think it is. It's, I have to confess, it's partly from having these experiences that I'm able to write these books that motivated me to write these books.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah, you know, that's a really good point that you make. You know, when I think about like religious family members that try and, you know, tell me about how real, you know, the God is that they believe in, it is usually kind of couched in this, you know, language of, well, you know, when you're in great need and, you know, you're suffering and you need help. And it does seem to be that those would be the times that would be expected to come up, even if it's not necessarily, you know, always described that way up front. That does seem to be you know, the times that people are having those experiences. That's interesting.
It's one of the ways it happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
And there are other people where they describe it differently. Mm-hmm. One of the religious scientists that I've read a lot of is Alistair Hardy. He's a British marine biologist. He died in the mid 1980s, but he wrote a lot about this. He had these sense presence feelings a lot when he was a kid and a teenager growing up. He was a naturalist. He'd go out in nature and collect butterflies and study plants and things like that. And he would get these rapt experiences of just being embraced by nature and would sense the presence of a nurturing, loving, generous God who made this nature possible for him to experience. So for him, it was different. For him, it was not a time of despair, but it was a different kind of emotional extreme, an extreme rapture with nature.
That sounds a little bit more pleasant. All right, well, Helen, do you want to ask one more question before we start to wrap up?
Yeah, because this was something I was just curious about when you were talking about, you know, feeling that other presence. That does that relate to people having those out-of-body experiences where you feel yourself floating out of your body and looking, you know, you're having that, you know, third-person perception of your own self?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up because it was one of the things I wanted to talk about in the talk and just didn't have time for. I showed you how when neurologists or neurosurgeons are electrically stimulating the cortex of an epileptic patient in preparation for, you know, trying to figure out where their seizures are coming from. Mm-hmm. If you stimulate the temporoparietal junction, the TPJ, you can sometimes get these sense presence illusions. Another kind of illusion you get from the same part of the brain are these out-of-body experiences. There's a paper, I don't know, 10 years ago, in Nature, where they were doing the same kind of thing, doing electrical stimulation in the brain, and a woman who was conscious during this, they were stimulating her TPJ, and she said, "I'm floating above the bed. I'm 8 feet above the bed, looking down. All I can see are my legs and my lower body, but I'm floating above the bed." And they could turn the intensity of the stimulating current and make the illusion stronger or weaker. It was a fascinating paper. So yes, it's the same kind of thing. These illusions of embodiment, a lot of them happen in that same part of the brain.
Fascinating.
Wow. Yeah, that really is interesting. So real quickly, I just want to, again, thank Dr. Wathy for coming and sharing all of this with us and taking the time to explain this incredibly complex argument that is super fascinating. And I cannot wait to finish reading the book. We are so glad to have you back again.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.